It is 7:20 on Wednesday. And if it's 7:20 on Wednesday, you know that John Olson is lurking somewhere in the heather to talk with us about the importance of issues happening around the world. Good morning, Mr. Olson. How are you?
Rich, how the heck are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. We're talking off the air. I'm getting ready to have knee surgery tomorrow, so it's I'm in a good mood because this situation that's been bugging me for about 3 months is going to get itself at least figured out. So
yeah, make sure you keep it elevated and ice it for a couple of days. Don't walk on it.
That's what they tell me. We'll see how it goes, man. I got things to do, so I ain't got time, John. I ain't got time to bleed. All right. So last night we were trying to figure out what exactly we should talk about, and I was sort of drawn at first to this the peace talks, or maybe I don't even know if we can call them peace talks between Ukraine and Russia, and the involvement or possibly lack thereof of the President of the United States. Can you sort of give us an update on where those peace talks might be?
Well, I don't think they're very productive right now.
Right.
In fact, I was just checking the news to see if there were any significant updates that came out.
Yeah.
President Trump, you know, put on Truth Social that Vladimir Putin has gone crazy with these attacks on Ukraine.
Yeah.
There was one specific quote that I'll read for you. What Vladimir Putin doesn't realize is that if it weren't for me, lots of really bad things would have already happened to Russia. And I mean, in all caps now, really bad. He's playing with fire. It's almost like, did the president not realize that for the last 3+ years, the Russians have been raining hell down on the Ukrainians?
Yeah. Well,
daily basis?
He believed.
I'm not really sure.
Coming into office, he absolutely believed he could end this war in 24 hours. And
well, that's what he said. That's what he said. I think the reality has certainly set in at this point that this is an almost intractable conflict as the current variables exist.
Right.
The hilarious thing is, you may remember Dmitry Medvedev,
yes.
Right? He sort of stepped in as the president of Russia for a year time period there during the Obama administration. And he seemed like a pretty rational guy to me.
Yes, he did.
Amongst Russian leaders. And it was really a placeholder move for him to serve in that role for 4 years while Putin served as the prime minister, and they changed the constitution so Putin could then come back in and serve 3 6-year terms back to back. So Medvedev has become a really vocal supporter of Putin and this war in Ukraine. And he actually responded to Trump saying, I only know of one really bad thing, World War III. I hope Trump understands this. And he has been the one that has threatened nuclear weapons use in the past as well. So Medvedev, he's kind of gone around the bend here, but this is obviously a very dangerous situation.
Yeah. Go ahead.
If you're interested, Rich,
yes.
I can give you and the listeners what I think has been going on since early days in this conflict.
Please.
I think most of the NATO allies were caught a little flat-footed about the fact that the Russians were going to invade Ukraine. U.S. intelligence, they supported the Biden administration in their policy initiatives, I think, to a degree we've never really seen before, with how much intelligence they helped declassify and then release to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Call out the Russians for what they were preparing to do. And it helped prepare the NATO allies for the reality of what was coming with an actual Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, I think a lot of people, and I'm one of them, really thought that the Russians were going to steamroller the Ukrainians and capture Kyiv, and basically then we'd be in sort of a standoff. I mean, an occupied Ukraine most of the country possibly for an indefinite period of time. Mm-hmm. And instead what happened was the Russians wind up choosing the worst possible time of year to carry out an attack using, you know, really heavy tracked vehicles like tanks and armored personnel carriers and whatnot. And so they had to use the roads because the ground itself right. was too soft, too muddy, and they would have gotten stuck in a heartbeat. So they channelized themselves right into the kill zones that the Ukrainians had set up, and the Ukrainians were able to blunt that initial offensive and then fairly quickly push the Russians back over the course of a couple of months, despite being inferior in numbers. And if you remember, there's been lots of debates in the news amongst people on both sides of the aisle, people who are national security experts, hammering away at the Biden administration. Why are you not sending everything we've got to the Ukrainians so they can force the Russians out of their country? And you didn't see too much of that in the international press, hammering away at the Germans and the Brits and the French and everybody else. The European Union, our NATO allies over in the EU, they did step up to the plate and they started sending lots of weapons, just like we did, mm-hmm. to Ukraine. But it was always just enough to make sure that they could stop Russian offenses, right. offensive moves, right?
Right.
And maybe push the Russians back a little bit here and there, but mostly to sort of stabilize the battlefield. So why would we only give the Ukrainians enough weaponry to blunt any Russian offensives, but not enough to just eject the Russians completely from Ukraine? Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I remember having a conversation with a gentleman who used to run a show here on KYMN called National Security This Week. And I asked him that same question. And he just kind of looked at me and gave me that quizzical answer like, well, isn't it obvious? It's to basically bleed Russia dry turn support away inside of Russia for Vladimir Putin.
Yep. And I think that's been the whole NATO strategy since very early in this conflict. And obviously the history books are going to have to dive into the classified briefings and decision making that NATO carried out in the early days of this war. And we're probably not going to find out what the truth was amongst the leaders of the NATO countries for probably 25 to 40 years. We'll see how long it takes for them to declassify that information. But it's been a pretty effective strategy in history. I mean, if you look what we did during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, we gave the Mujahideen weapons that allowed them to really hammer away at the Russians. And the Russians eventually, the Soviets, I should say, eventually chose to withdraw from Afghanistan because they couldn't win.
Right.
I am pretty sure I don't have access to classified intelligence anymore, but I'm pretty sure that Russia and China and a few other countries were arming up the Taliban because it came streaming into Kabul on international TV. They had a lot of brand new weapons.
Yes, they did.
Where did they get those, right? They bled us for 20 years until we finally decided to withdraw. Mm-hmm. So it's a good strategy. It's a long-term strategy. You have to practice strategic patience if you're going to use that strategy. But what it does do is it has trapped Vladimir Putin in a strategic blunder for having actually invaded Ukraine and not succeeded in beating the Ukrainians. And I think at this point, there's no way the Russians can beat the Ukrainians based on the fact that their economy continues to get worse. The casualties they're taking on a near daily basis, like 1,000 casualties a day. I mean, that's over time, that will eventually force Russian mothers to stand against Vladimir Putin. So I think the idea has been NATO can't remove Putin from outside of Russia,
right.
But the Russian people can certainly remove Putin from inside of Russia. Now, the only challenge that we have there is who's going to do the removing? Because I don't think Vladimir Putin is ready to step down anytime soon.
No.
So if it's the, you know, the apparatus of state, like the defense ministry partnering with the FSB and the Rosguardia, which is like their national guard inside of Russia. If those three entities came together and decided we've taken enough casualties, the political elites here have got to go, including maybe the oligarchs that Putin has created and made, you know, billionaires 10 times over.
Mm-hmm.
A clean house. There's an opportunity for the Russian people to have a reset and reform their government and return back to actual democratic governance. My concern is that the people who are more likely to take a stand against Putin and remove him because of his failures are the Russian ultra-nationalists.
Yeah.
And that's a dangerous lot, those guys.
Yeah.
They are a little unhinged, and they are the ones who are threatening on a regular basis the use of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. I think Putin understands that that would be a really, really bad idea. But the ultra-nationalists that he's kind of kept in check for a long time now, if they are the ones who remove him and they take power, oh boy, we've got some challenges.
Yeah, I've always kind of thought that when you see a coup d'etat in an adversarial nation, well, even in an allied nation, but in an adversarial nation especially, you really, really, really want to be careful and cautious, because what they're doing is removing the devil you know. And
exactly.
It's why I've never really been a big fan of engineering regime change inside of a country, but that's a whole different conversation.
It could certainly go sideways, right? If you look at what happened with Yugoslavia and Marshal Tito passes away,
right?
It didn't take long for the different ethnic groups inside of the former Yugoslavia to break apart into multiple different countries, and there was a hell of a lot of bloodshed that followed. You look at what happened in Libya when the people were able to rise up and bounce Gaddafi out of there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was summarily executed on a desert highway.
Yeah.
But then there was a lot of strife within the system, and it still hasn't really shaken out completely. Iraq is still trying to recover from Saddam Hussein.
Right.
I mean, these are the things that happen when a dictatorship collapses. Yep. Syria might actually be the one place where an overthrow of a regime is sort of coming together in what looks like a relatively stable situation.
Even some rationality being introduced into that new regime, despite the fact that the head person there is a former member of the Islamic State.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy. Right? Yeah. What a crazy mixed up world we're living
right,
in.
Right, exactly. You just never know what you're going to get. It's like the world's a box of chocolates, John. So getting back to Ukraine, and these massive attacks now that Russia has unleashed on civilian targets. One of the conversations you and I had a couple of years ago, you told me that you really thought that Russia, even back then, could not win in Ukraine, but when it was over, there wasn't going to be anything left in Ukraine either. And with the U.S. having, we've pulled back our support, obviously, from Ukraine.
Yes.
and left a little bit of a vacuum. Well, actually, quite a bit of a vacuum. There's two things I want to ask you about here. First of all, is this where Putin clearly raises his strategy and just starts blowing everything up in Ukraine? And secondly, President Zelensky is in Germany right now, and what's happening with the EU, I think, is really interesting. Where do you want to start with all that?
Well, let's start with the EU side of things.
Okay.
I mean, I think they realize that when America reelected Donald Trump for a second term, and the rhetoric was clearly that the U.S. didn't have a lot of interest in this war. I mean, during the early stages of the Trump administration, you heard people like Marco Rubio, as Secretary of State, saying, hey, if Ukraine can't get on board with this peace deal, then we're going to walk away.
Yep.
And essentially now I think Trump and his senior leadership in the national security arena are realizing that the problem here is actually Russia, which is what everybody else has been saying since before Russia even invaded Ukraine. The Russians are not prepared to carry out a 30-day ceasefire. which Zelensky openly and immediately agreed to in a heartbeat, mm-hmm. right? Because he's trying mm-hmm. to keep people in his country from being killed by these Russian attacks. But the Russians are not willing to stop. And when you are preparing to negotiate for a peace deal, unfortunately, that tends to be a time when the most aggressive military offensives start, because you're trying to gain as much ground as possible.
Yep.
Even if it's just to use that ground as a poker chip in the big game, right? As part of negotiations, how do you give back territory in exchange for something you might want, that you actually want? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to me, the European Union has stepped up to the plate. They have made a decision to rearm their countries at a very high level of defense spending compared to what they've done for a long time now. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many of them are going to get to 5% of GDP for defense spending. That's a lot.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They're moving upwards in how much they're spending. About $1 trillion amongst the NATO alliance members, amongst the EU members, I should say, for defense spending. There was a point there where when there was a clear fracture taking place between where the EU was and where the Trump administration policies were on defense of Europe and certainly support for Ukraine, European defense stocks skyrocketed because the EU decided to buy, you know, local, buy yeah. from their own defense producers rather than the American defense industry. And the American defense industry stocks actually came down a good bit for a short period of time during that that whole episode. So the Europeans are serious about rearming themselves and trying to get more weaponry into Ukraine. And that's why Zelensky is constantly traveling to the European capitals to talk to political leaders to continue to get the support he must have to stop the Russians. So I think the Europeans get it that, you know, they have 450 million people in the EU.
Yep.
They have a pretty huge economy when you consider all of the EU together. They should have been spending more. I think they know that.
Yeah.
So there is a rebalancing that's happening right now. I don't take anything away from the Trump administration for having convinced the Europeans that they need to spend more money on their own defense. It's just the methodology he used, I think, was unnecessarily confrontational.
Yeah.
And undermined our really good relationship with our NATO allies and our EU trading partners. So.
Yeah, that's just sort of how it feels too. I mean, it's there's a little bit of a a country like Germany steps up now, and it feels like there's a little bit of a sneer towards the United States at the same time, and it's hard to see. For someone who grew up believing that NATO was just one of those things that was foundational and rock solid, and you know, the idea of the United States and a NATO country not getting along was just would
inconceivable.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, here we are. So where does that leave then Vladimir Putin with all of this?
Well, I mean, he's still in a quagmire, right? Yeah. I mean, even with all the ordnances that he's expending right now, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, heavily armed drones, you know, you name it, the longer range strikes into, you know, cities all across Ukraine, he's still, you know, they're still trying to carry out offensives on the ground where the lines are, the battle lines around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, now would be the time to pour a lot of military assistance, weaponry and whatnot, fighter jets, you name it. Give that stuff to the Ukrainians to really force the Russians to rethink whether or not they want to continue this war.
Yeah.
But the U.S. is apparently sitting this one out. Uh-huh. We have continued to ratchet back on how much we're providing to Ukraine. I don't know if this tiff that's gone on now between President Trump and Vladimir Putin, if that's going to change the administration's mind on speeding more lethal military aid to Ukraine. Maybe it will. I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting situation we see unfolding before us right now.
Yeah, I believe they call these unprecedented times.
Yeah, that's a good way to frame it. That's a good way.
Yeah, thanks, man. All right. Hey, John, we always do appreciate the time, sir, and we'll look forward to talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, well, thank you very kindly. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
All right.
There he is, Mr.